before the day, quite a while before.
Does Lib know about her?
She knows all about it. She says Rita doesn't bother her because Rita is part of the past, like Mayoshi's in Tokyo. You know who worries Lib? Helen. Imagine that. They were at the Hernandez house. Dan stopped the car. He said, I can imagine it. Lib is an extremely sensitive, perceptive woman. About some things, she has more sense than you have, Randy. And all rules are off now. Randy wasn't listening. Rita had stepped out of the doorway. In Hawaii, Randy had seen girls of mixed Caucasian, Polynesian, and Chinese blood, hips moving as if to the pulse of island rhythm even when only crossing the street, who reminded him of Rita. She was not like a girl of Fort Repose. She was a child of the Mediterranean and Caribbean, seeming alien and yet certainly American. Her ancestors included a Spanish soldier whose caravelle beached in Matanzas Inlet before the pilgrims found their rock, and Carib Indian women, and the Menorcans who spread inland from New Smyrna in the 18th century. She had not gone to college, but she was intelligent and quick. She had an annulled high school marriage and an abortion behind her. She no longer made such foolish errors. Her hobby was men. She sampled and enjoyed men as other women collected and enjoyed African violets, Limoges teacups, or sterling souvenir teaspoons. She was professional in her avocation, never letting a man go without some profit, not necessarily material, and never trading one man for another unless she thought she was bettering her collection. Under any circumstances, Rita was an arresting woman. Her hair was cut in straight bangs to form an ebony frame for features carved like a Malayan mask in antique ivory. She could look and behave like an Egyptian queen of the 18th dynasty or a Creole whore out of New Orleans. On this morning, she wore aquamarine shorts and halter. Cradled easily under her right arm was a light repeating shotgun. She was smoking a cigarette, and even from the road, Randy could see that it was a real, manufactured filter tip and not a stubby homemade hand-rolled with toilet paper. She called, "Hello, Dr. Gunn. Come on in." Then she recognized the passenger and yelled, "Hey, Randy!" Dan put the car keys in his pocket and said, "Better bring the whiskey and honey, Randy. I never leave stuff in the car when I make a call in Pistolville." As he walked to the house, Randy noticed the Atlas grocery truck and a big new sedan in the Hernandez carport and a Jaguar XK150 sports car in the driveway. A latrine had been dug behind the carport and partly shielded from the road by a crude board fence. Rita swung open the screen door. "You'll pardon the artillery," she said. "The goons down the street are envious. When I hear a car or anything, I grab a gun. They killed my dog. She was a black poodle, Randy. Her name was Poupée Vivant. That means living doll in French. Cracked her skull with an axe handle while Peter was lying sick and I was off fetching water. I found the axe handle but not the body. The goddamn cracker scum. Ate her, I guess." Randy thought how he would feel if someone killed and ate Graff. He was revolted, and yet it was a matter of manners and mores. In China, men for centuries had been eating dogs stuffed with rice. It happened in other meat-starved Asian countries. The army had put him through a survival course once and taught him that in an emergency he could safely eat pulpy white grubs found under bark. It could happen here. If a man could eat grubs, he could eat dogs. Pistolville was meat-starved, and, as Dan had said, the rules were off. All Randy said was, "I'm sorry, Rita." Randy walked through the door and stopped, astonished. The two front rooms of the Hernandez place looked like show windows in a Miami auction house. He counted 3 silver tea services, 2 chests of flat silver, 3 television sets, and was bewildered by a display of statuary. Silver candelabra, expensive leather cases, empty crystal decanters, table lighters, chinaware. Gold-framed oils and watercolors, some fairly good, plastered one wall. Table clocks and wall clocks raised their hands and swore to different times. "Great God," Randy said. "Have you people gone into the junk business?" Rita laughed. "It's not junk. It's my investment." Dan said, "How's Pete, Rita?" "I think he's a little better. He's not losing any more hair, but he's still weak." Dan was carrying his black bag. It held little except instruments now. He said, "I'll go back and see him." Dan walked down the hall and Randy was alone with her. She offered him a cigarette. Her perfume opened the gates of memory. The movies in Orlando. The dinners and dancing at the hotel in Winter Park. The isolated motel south of Canaveral. The morning they found a secluded pocket behind the dunes and were buzzed by a light plane, and how the pilot almost sideslipped into the sea, banking around for a second look, and most of all, his apartment. It seemed so long ago, as if it had happened while he was in college, before Korea, but it was not so long, a year only. He said, "Thanks, Rita. First real cigarette I've had in a long, long time. You must be getting along all right." She looked at the bottle. "You didn't bring me a present, did you, Randy?" The corners of her mouth quivered, but she did not quite smile. He remembered the evenings he had come to this house, a bottle beside him on a seat, and they had gone tooting off together. And the evenings he had brought bottles in gift packages, discreet gratuities for a brother, and the nights in the apartment, sharing a decanter, drink for drink, because she loved her liquor. He realized that this is what she intended he remember. She was expert at making him feel uncomfortable. He said, "No, Rita. Trade goods. I've been in Marines Park trying to trade for coffee." "Got your new women like Scotch, Randy? I hear you've got two women in your house now. Which one are you sleeping with, Randy?" Suddenly, she was a stranger, and he looked upon her as such. Examined thus, with detachment, she looked ridiculous, wearing high heels and costume jewelry with shorts and halter at this hour of the morning and in this time of troubles. Her darkling ivory skin, once so satiny, appeared dry and mottled. Her hair was dull, and the luster in her eyes reflected only spiteful anger. She looked used and tired. He said calmly, "You can take your claws out now. I don't feel them. My skin's tougher." She licked her lips. They were puffed and brown. "You're tougher. You're not the same, Randy. I guess you're growing up." He changed the subject. "Where did you get all this stuff?" He looked around the room. "Trading. I never see you in Marines Park. We don't go there. They come to us. They know we still hold food, even coffee." He knew she wanted the bottle. He knew she would trade coffee, but he would never again trade with her for anything. He said, "You said this was your investment. Do you think 3 television sets is a good investment when there isn't any electricity?" "I'm looking ahead, Randy. This war isn't going to last forever. And when it's over, I'm going to have everything I never had before, and plenty besides, maybe to sell. I was only a kid after the last big war, but I remember how my dad had to pay through the nose for an old jalopy. Do you know what that jag cost me?" She laughed. "A case of beans, 3 bottles of ketchup, and 6 cans of deviled ham. For a jag! Say, as soon as things get back to normal, those 3 TV sets will be worth their weight in gold." "Do you really think things are going to get back to normal?" "Sure. They always have, haven't they? It may be a year, even 2. I can wait. You look at those big new houses out on River Road. What built half of them? Wars. Profits out of wars. This time I'm going to get mine." He saw that she believed it, and it was pointless to argue with her. Still, he was intrigued. "Don't you realize that this war is different?" She held out her left hand so that the sunlight glinted on the ring on her second finger.
It certainly is different. Look at this.
He looked at the big stone and into it, and a thousand blue and red lights attested to its worth and purity. It wasn't costume jewelry, as he had surmised. It wasn't glass surrounded by green paste. It was a diamond set in emeralds. "Where did you get it?" he asked, awed, and then he looked at her crescent ear clips and saw that they too, beyond a doubt, were diamonds. Rita held the ring out, turning her wrist. She did not answer at once. She was enjoying their reaction.
6 carats, she said. Perfect.
She slipped it from her finger and handed it to Randy. He took it automatically, but he wasn't looking at it. He was looking at her finger. Her finger was marred by a dark, almost black circle, as if the ring were tarnished brass or its inside sooty. But the ring was clean, bright white gold. Dan came into the room, pawing in his bag and frowning.
"I don't know exactly,"
he began, looked at Randy's face, and failed to finish the sentence. Frowning, Rita inspected the dark band.
"It itches," she said, and scratched.
A bit of blackened skin flaked away, leaving raw flesh beneath.
"I asked you where you got this, Rita," Randy said, a command.
Before she opened her mouth, he guessed the answer. She said,
"Porky Logan."
The ring dropped to the floor, bounced, tinkled, and came to rest on the corner of a blue silk Chinese rug.
"Say, what's the matter?" she said. "You act like it was hot."
"I think it is hot," Randy said. "Well, if you think Porky stole it, you're wrong. It was abandoned property. Anybody would take it."
Dan took her hand and adjusted his bifocal so he could examine the finger closely. He spoke, his voice deep, enforcing calm.
"Hold still, Rita. I just want to see that finger. I think what Randy meant was that the ring has been exposed to radioactivity and is now radioactive itself. I'm afraid he's right. This looks like a burn, a radium burn. How long have you been wearing that ring?"
"Off and on, for a month, I guess. I never wear it outside, only in the house," she hesitated. "But this last week, I've had it on all the time. I never noticed."
They looked down at it, its facets blinking at them from the soft blue silk as if it were in a display window. It looked beautiful.
"Where did Porky get it, Rita?" Dan asked. "Well, I only know what he told me. He was fishing in the Keys on the day, and of course he started right back. He's smart, Porky is. He made a big detour around Miami. While he was passing through Hollywood or Boca Raton or one of those Gold Coast places, and it was empty, and right off the main drag he saw one of those swanky little jewelry shops, you know, a branch of some Fifth Avenue store, and its windows were blown out. He said stuff was lying all over, rings and pins and watches and bracelets like popcorn out of a busted bag. So he gathered it up. Then he dumped the hooks and plugs and junk out of his fish box and went inside and filled it up. Porky said right then he was thinking of the future. He figured that money wouldn't be worth anything, but diamonds and gold were different. They never lost value, no matter what happened."
"Impregnated with fallout," Dan murmured. "Suicide."
Rita's hands crept upward to her neck, and Randy noticed an oval mark in the hollow of her throat, as if the skin were painted darker there.
Then her hands flew to her ears. The diamond ear clips fell to the rug beside the ring. She moaned,
"Oh, God."
"What did you have to give Porky for those diamonds?" Randy asked softly.
"For the ring, hardly anything at all. For the rest of it, we gave him canned meat and cigarettes and coffee and chocolate bars and stuff like that. You know how Porky ate. For Christ's sakes, Doc, what are you going to do about this?"
She stared at her finger.
"What else did Porky give you besides the diamonds?" Dan asked.
"All sorts of stuff. He gave us a double handful of watches just for a case of pork and beans. Pete has..."
She looked down the hallway. She said,
"Pete!"
and led them to his room.
Pete Hernandez didn't look as bad as Bill Cullen, but he looked bad enough, his scalp scabby as with mange, face erupting and hands swollen. He pushed himself back on his pillows, startled as they came in. Rita said, "Pete, take off those watches."
"Are you nuts?"
Pete was wearing a gold watch, pushed up absurdly on each skinny arm. Pete looked at their faces and said,
"Why should I take off my watches?"
Dan leaned down and stripped them off and tossed them on a table. The flexible gold straps left black insignia. They are radioactive. That gold is a hot isotope of gold. They've been poisoning you. Look. Pete looked down.
"It's just dirt. It's the heat. I've been sweating."
Randy asked the question, "Where's the rest of Porky's jewelry, Pete?" Pete looked at Rita, his dulled black eyes uncertain and appealing. He said,
"They just want to get our golden stones, Rita."
"Randy doesn't lie, Pete, and I don't think Dr. Gunn would steal anything from anybody." Pete curled his arm to reach under his pillow. Dan said, "Oh, good Lord," pitying him. From under the pillow, Pete brought out a plastic toilet kit. "Open it," Dan said. Pete unzipped it. It was packed full, watch bands twisting and curling like golden snakes. "Is that all?" Dan asked.
"No, those are just the watches," Rita said. "Pete's been amusing himself, admiring them and winding them every day. There's more stuff in my room. A couple of necklaces and a ruby and diamond brooch and, well, all sorts of junk."
"Pete," Dan said, "throw that kit in the corner there. Rita, don't touch anything you may have in your bedroom. There's no point in your absorbing even another fraction of a Rentgen. We've got to figure out a way to get the stuff out of here and get rid of it without damaging ourselves. We'll be back." Rita followed them to the door, whimpering. She snatched at Dan's sleeve.
"What's going to happen? Am I going to die? Is my hair going to fall out?"
"You haven't absorbed nearly as much radiation as your brother," Dan said. "I don't know exactly what's going to happen because radiation sickness is so tricky."
"What about Pete? What'll I do if Pete..."
"I'm afraid," Dan said, "that Pete is slipping into leukemia."
"Blood cancer?"
"Yes. I'm afraid you'd better prepare yourself." Rita's hands fell from Dan's arm. Randy watched her diminish, all allure, all bravado, falling away, leaving her smaller and like a child. He said quietly, "Rita, you'd better keep this here. You'll need it." He gave her the bottle of scotch. As he pressed the starter, Dan said, "Why did you give her the whiskey?"
"I feel sorry for her."
That wasn't the only reason. If he had owed her anything before, he did no longer. They were quits. They were square.
"Is she going to be all right?"
he asked. "I think so, unless a malignancy develops from the burn on her finger. Improbable, but possible. Yes, she should be all right so far as radiation goes. The dose she absorbed was localized. But after her brother dies, she'll be alone. Then she won't be all right."
"She'll find a man," Randy said. "She always has."
Porky Logan's house stood at the end of Augustine Road, in a grove that rose up a hillside at the back of the house. It was a two-story brick, the largest house in Pistolville, so it was said. Porky's sister and niece had been caring for him, but he lived alone. His wife and two children had departed Pistolville 10 years before. They found Porky on the second floor. He was sitting up in bed, unshaven chin resting upon blotched bare chest. Between his knees was a beer case filled with jewelry. His hands were buried to the forearm in this treasure. Dan said, "Porky." Porky didn't raise his head. Porky was dead. Dan stepped to the bed, pushed Porky's body back against the pillows, and pried an eyelid open. Dan said, "Let's get him out of here. That's a furnace he's got in his lap." Randy tried not to breathe going down the steps. It was not only the smell of Porky's room that hurried him. Dan said, "We've got to keep people out of this house until we can get Porky and that hot stuff underground. How do we do it?"
"What about a sign? We could paint a sign."
They found an unopened can of yellow paint and a brush in Porky's garage. Dan used the brush on the front door. In block letters he wrote, "Danger. Keep out. Radiation."
"You'd better put something else on there," Randy said. "There are a lot of people around here who still don't know what radiation means."
"Do you really think so?"
"I'm positive of it. They've never seen it or felt it. They hear about it, but I don't think they believe it. They didn't believe it could kill them before the day, if they thought of it at all, and I don't think they believe it now.
You'd better add something they understand, like poison."
So, under radiation, Dan printed poison.
He said, "One other, Bill Cullen."
Big Mouth Bill was as they had left him, except that he held a bottle of cheap rum in his misshapen hands and had been hitting it. Randy hovered at the door so he could listen but not be submerged in the odors.
Dan said, "Bill, we found out what's making you sick. You're absorbing radiation from the jewelry Porky traded for the whiskey. Porky's jewelry is hot. It's radioactive. Where is it?"
Bill laughed wildly. He began to curse methodically and without imagination, as Randy had heard troops curse in the MLR in Korea. The pace of his obscenities quickened. He choked, frothed, and pulled at the rum bottle.
"Jewelry!"
he yelled, his yellow eyeballs rolling.
"Jewelry! Diamonds, emeralds, pearls, tinkly little bracelets, all hot, all radioactive. That's rich."
"Where is it, Bill?" Dan's voice was sharper.
"Ask her, as the dough-faced bitch. She has them, has the whole boot full."
"What do you mean?"
"I've been hiding the stuff, figuring if she got her hands on it, she'd swap it all for a bottle of vino. The jewels in one boot, the rum in the other. Believe it or not, this is the last of my stock."
He sucked at the bottle.
"Go on," Dan said.
"I kept the boots, these boots here."
He gestured at a pair of hunting boots.
"Hid under the bed. It was safe, okay. You see, my woman, she never cleaned anything, especially she never cleaned under the bed. Well, when she went out for a while, I thought I'd take a look at the loot. You know, it was nice to hold it in your hands and dream about what you were going to do with it when things got back to normal. But she was watching through the window. She's been trying to catch me, and just a while ago she did. She walked in grinning. I thought she was going to tell me the war was over or something. She walked in and reached under the bed and snatched the boot. All she said as she went through the door was, 'I hope you croak, you sneaky bastard. I'm going back to Apalachicola.'"
Fascinated, Randy asked, "How does she expect to get to Apalachicola?"
"I keep Captain Plymouth in the shed. It was nearly full of gas. What was in the drum I had to service the outboards. I hope she wrecks."
Dan picked up his bag. His huge shoulders sagged. His face was unhappy behind the red beard.
"Do you still have that ointment I gave you?"
"Yes."
Bill turned his head toward the table. "Keep using it on your hands. It may give you relief."
"It may, but this will."
Bill tilted the rum bottle and drank until it gagged.
Riding back on River Road, Randy said, "Will Cullen live?"
"I doubt it. I don't have the drugs or antibiotics or blood transfusions for him."
He reached down and patted his bag.
"Not much left in here, Randy. I have to make decisions now. I have drugs only for those worth saving."
"What about the woman?"
"I don't think she'll die of radiation sickness. I don't think she'll keep that hot gold and silver and platinum long enough. She'll either swap for booze or, being stupid, try one of the main highways."
"I think the highwaymen will get her if she's headed for Apalachicola," Randy said.
It was strange that the term highwaymen had revived in its true and literal sense. These were not the romantic and reputedly chivalrous highwaymen of Britain's post-Rhodes in the 16th and 17th centuries. These new highwaymen were ruthless and evil men who lately had been choking the thin trickle of communications and trade between towns and villages. Mostly, according to word that filtered into Fort Repose, they operated on the main highways like the Turnpike and Routes 1, 441, 17, and 50. So they were called highwaymen. They passed the empty McGovern place. It was already lushly overgrown. "You know," Dan said, "in a few more months, the jungle will take over." 9. They buried Porky Logan Friday morning. It was a ticklish and exhausting procedure. Randy had to draw his gun to get it done. First, it was necessary to obtain the cooperation of Bubba Offenhaus. That was difficult enough. Bubba's funeral parlor was locked and empty, and he was no longer seen in town. Since he was deputy director of civil defense as well as undertaker, a public appearance exposed him to all sorts of requests and problems which frightened him and about which he could do nothing. So Bubba and Kitty Offenhaus could only be found in their big new house, a rare combination of modern and classic, constructed largely of tinted glass between antebellum Greek columns. When Randy found Bubba sitting on his terrace, he looked like a balloon out of which air had been let. His trousers sagged front and rear, and folds of skin drooped around his mouth. Dan explained about Porky. Bubba was unimpressed. "Let them bury him in Pistolville," he said. "Plant him in his own backyard." "It can't be done that way," Dan said. "Porky's a menace, and the jewelry is deadly. Bubba, what we've got to have is a lead-lined coffin. We'll bury his loot with him." "You know very well I've only got one in stock," Bubba said. "As a matter of fact, it's the only casket I've got left, and probably the only casket in Timequin County. It's the deluxe model with hammered bronze handles and shield, which can be suitably engraved and reinforced bronze corners. Guaranteed for eternity, and I'm damned if I'm going to give it up for Porky Logan." "Who are you saving it for?" Randy asked. "Yourself?" "I don't see any point in you becoming insulting, Randy. That casket cost me $845 FOB, and it retails for $1,500 plus tax. Who's going to pay for it? As a matter of fact, who's going to reimburse me for all the other caskets and everything else that I've contributed since the day?" "I'm sure the government will," Dan said, "one day." "Do you think the government's going to restore repose in Peace Park? Do you think it'll pay for all those choice plots I've handed out free? Like fun? I suppose you want to bury Porky and repose in peace." "That's the general idea," Dan said. "And you expect me to use my hearse to cart the cadaver?" "Somebody has to do it, Bubba. And you're not only the man with the hearse, but you're in civil defense." Bubba groaned. The most stupid thing he had ever done was accept the civil defense job. At the time, it had seemed quite an honor. His appointment was mentioned in the Orlando and Tampa papers, and he rated a whole page with picture in the Southeast Mortician. It was undoubtedly a bigger thing than holding office in the Lions or Chamber of Commerce. His status had increased, even with his wife. Kitty was old Southern family, which he had been raised in South Chicago. She had never wholly forgiven him for this or for his profession. Secretly, he had considered civil defense a boondoggle, like handouts to foreign countries and spending millions on moon rockets and such. He had never imagined there would be a war. It was true that after the day he and Kitty had been able to get supplies in San Marco that he wouldn't have been able to get if he hadn't been in civil defense. For one thing, he had been able to get gasoline out of the county garage, but the tanks had long been dry, all other official supplies exhausted. He said, "I've only got one hearse that will run and only a couple of gallons of gas in it. I'm saving it for an emergency." "This is an emergency," Dan said. "You'll have to use it now." Bubba thought of another obstacle.
It'll take 8 men to tote that lead-lined casket with Porky in it, even if he's lost weight like I have.
Randy spoke. We'll get them. Plenty of strong men hanging around Marines Park. In the park, they mounted the bandstand. Randy shouted, "Hey, everybody, come over here." The traders drifted over, wondering. Bubba made a little speech. Bubba was accustomed to speaking at service club luncheons and civic meetings, but this audience, although many of the faces were familiar, was not the same. It was neither attentive nor courteous. He spoke of community spirit and cooperation and togetherness. He reminded them that they had sent Porky Logan to the state legislature, and he knew Porky must have been a friend to many there. Now he asked for volunteers to help bury Porky. No hands went up. A few of the traders snickered. Bubba shrugged and looked at Dan Gunn. Dan said, "This is in your own interest. If we leave the dead unburied, we are inviting an epidemic. In addition, in this case, we must get rid of radioactive material that can be dangerous to anyone who finds it." Somebody yelled, "Bubba's the undertaker, ain't he? We'll let him undertake it." Some of the men laughed. Randy saw that they were bored and would soon turn away. It was necessary that he act. He stepped in front of Dan, lifted the flap of his holster, and drew out the .45. Holding it casually, so that it was a menace to no one in particular and yet to each of them separately, he pulled back the hammer. His left forefinger jabbed at the faces of 5 men, big men. "You, Rusty, and you, Tom, and you there, you have just volunteered as pallbearers." They looked at him amazed. For a long time, no one had ordered them to do anything. For a long time, there had not even been a boss on a job. Nobody moved. Some of the traders carried handguns in hip pockets or holsters. Others had leaned shotguns or rifles against benches or the bandstand railing. Randy watched for a movement. He was going to shoot the first man who reached for a weapon. This was the decision he had made. Regardless of the consequences, he was going to do it. Having made the decision and being certain he would carry it out, he felt easy about it. He realized they must know this. He stepped down from the bandstand, his eyes holding his 5 volunteers. He said, "All right, let's get going." The 5 men followed him, and he holstered his pistol. So they buried Porky Logan. With him, they buried the contaminated loot in Porky's carton and out of the Hernandez house. Also into the coffin went the fire tongs with which Dan Gunn had handled the jewelry. When the grave was filled and mounded, somebody said, "Hadn't there ought to be a prayer for the poor bastard?" They all looked at Randy. Randy said, "God rest his soul." He added, knowing that it would be passed along, "And God help anybody who digs him up to get the stuff. It'll kill them like it killed Porky." He turned and walked slowly, head down to the car, thinking. Authority had disintegrated in Fort Repose. The mayor, Alexander Getty, who was also chairman of the town council, was barricaded in his house, besieged by imaginary and irrational fears that the Russians had invaded and were intent on his capture, torture, and the rape of his wife and daughter. The chief of police was dead. The 2 other policemen had abandoned unpaid public duty to scramble for their families. The fire and sanitation departments, equipment immobilized, no longer existed. Bubba Offenhaus was frightened, bewildered, and incapable of either decision or action. So Randy had shoved his gun into this vacuum. He had assumed leadership, and he was not sure why. It was enough trouble keeping the colony on River Road alive and well. He felt a loneliness not unfamiliar. It was like leading a platoon out of the MLR to occupy some isolated outpost. Command, whether of a platoon or a town, was a lonely state. When they returned to River Road at noon, Randy's boat shoes were stiff with caked clay of the graveyard.
He was knocking them clear of clods on the front steps when he was attracted by movement in the foliage behind Florence Wetchek's house. Alice Cooksey and Florence were standing under a tall cabbage palm steadying a ladder. At the top of the ladder, head and shoulders hidden by fronds, was Lib. He wondered why she must be up there. He wished she would stay on the ground. She took too many chances. She could get hurt. With medical supplies dwindling, Dan had already been forced to use most of their reserve. They all had to be careful. Everyone had chores, and if one was hurt, it meant added burdens, including nursing, on the others. A simple fracture could be compound disaster. Bill McGovern, Malachi, and Two-Tone Henry came around the corner of the house. Bill was wearing gray flannels, raggedly cut off above the knees, tennis shoes, and nothing else. His right hand grasped a bouquet of wrenches. Grease smeared his bald head and fine white beard. He no longer looked like a Caesar, but like an unkempt Jove armed with thunderbolts. Before he could speak, Randy demanded, "Bill, what's your daughter doing up that palm?" "She won't say," Bill said. "She and Alice and Florence are cooking up some sort of a surprise for us. Maybe she's found a bird's nest, I wouldn't know." Randy said, "What's the delegation?" Bill said, "It's Two-Tone's idea. Two-Tone, you talk." Two-Tone said, "Mr. Randy, you know my sugar cane will be tall and sweet and Pop's corn will be up in June." "So?" "Corn and sugar cane means corn whiskey. I mean, we can make shine if you says it's okay. Pop and Mr. Bill here, they say it's up to you. I suggests it only on one account. We can trade shine."
"Naturally, you wouldn't drink any, would you, Two-Tone?"
"Oh, no, sir."
Randy understood that they required something from him beyond permission. Yet if they could manufacture corn whiskey, it would be like finding coffee beans. Whiskey was a negotiable money crop. In this humid climate, both corn and sugarcane would deteriorate rapidly. Corn whiskey was different. The longer you kept it, the more valuable it became. Furthermore, only a few bottles of bourbon and scotch remained, and the bourbon was strictly medicinal, Dan's anesthetic. Two-Tone, a no-good genius. Cannily, all Randy said was, "If you have preacher's permission, it's all right with me. It's preacher's corn." Bill said, "I've already contributed my imperial."
"You've what?"
"Contributed the guts of my imperial. You see, to make the still, we have to have a lot of copper tubing. We have to bend condensing coils, and you have to have tubing between the boiler and condenser and so forth."
"What you're getting at," Randy said slowly, "is that you want me to contribute the gas lines out of my Bonneville."
"That's right. The lines out of my car won't give us enough length. And we have to have your lawn roller. You see, first we've got to build a mill to crush the cane. We have to get the juice and boil it down to molasses before we can make whiskey, or for that matter, use it as syrup. Balaam, the mule, will walk a circle, a lever harnessed to his back to turn the roller on concrete slabs. That's the mill. That's the way they did it a couple of hundred years ago. I've seen pictures."
Randy knew it would work. He said sadly, "Okay. Go into the garage, but I don't want to watch." It had been a beautiful car. He remembered Mark's casual prediction that it wouldn't be worth a damn to him. Mark had been wrong. Some of it was useful. Lunch was fish with half a lime. Orange juice, all you could drink. A square of honeycomb. Dan and Helen were at the table. The others had already finished. Helen always waited for him, Randy noticed. She was so solicitous, it was sometimes embarrassing. Dan looked at his plate and said, "A fine, thinning diet. If everybody in the country had been on this diet before the day, the cardiac death rate would have been cut in half."
"So what good would it have done them?" Randy said. He speared his honey and munched it, rolling his eyes. "We've got to do more trading with Jim Hickey. We've got to find something Jim needs." Randy remembered what Jim had said about half his broods going foul since the day and how Jim suspected radiation was responsible. He told Dan and Helen what Hickey had said. Dan stared at his plate troubled. He cut into his honeycomb and tasted it. "Delicious," he said, but his mind was elsewhere. At last he looked up and spoke gravely. "We shouldn't be surprised. Who can tell how much cesium-137 showered down on the day? How much was carried into the upper atmosphere and has been filtering down since? The geneticists warned us of damage to future generations. Well, Hickey's bees are in a future generation." Helen looked scared. Randy realized that this was a more serious matter to women than to men, although frightening enough to anybody. She said, "Does that mean, will it affect humans?"
"Certainly, some human genetic damage can be expected," Dan said. "What will happen to the birth rate is anybody's guess. And yet, this is only nature's way of protecting the race. Nature is proving Darwin's law of natural selection. The defective bee, unable to cope with its environment, is rejected by nature before birth. I think this will be true of man. It is said that nature is cruel. I don't think so. Nature is just and even merciful. By natural selection, nature will attempt to undo what man has done."
"You make it sound comforting," Helen said.
"Only an opinion, based on almost no evidence. In 6 or 7 months, I'll know more. But to evaluate everything may take 1,000 years. So, let's not worry about it. Right now, I've got other worries, like tires. The tires on the Model A are smooth, Randy, and I've got to make a couple of calls out in the country. Got any suggestions?"
"I've been thinking of tires," Randy said. "The tires on Florence's old Chevy will fit the Model A. 2 of them are almost new. Let's go over and make the change."
It was the custom of Randy and Dan to meet in the apartment at 6 each evening, listen for the clear channel station which would be heard at this hour, if at all, and if they were tired and the rigors of the day warranted, share a drink. At 6 on that Friday evening, Dan had not returned from his calls, so Randy sat at his bar alone with the little transistor portable. Life was ebbing from its last set of batteries. He feared the day when it would no longer pick up even the strongest signal or give any sound whatsoever, and the day could not be far distant. So what strength was left in the batteries he carefully rationed. Sam Hazard's all-wave receiver operating on recharged automobile batteries was really their only reliable source of information. He clicked on the radio, was relieved to hear static, and tried the Conelrad frequencies. Immediately, he heard a familiar voice, thin and gravelly, although he turned the volume full.
"Against smallpox?"
Randy knew he had missed the first item of news. Then he heard,
"There have been isolated reports of disorders in outlawry from several of the contaminated zones. As a result, Mrs. Van Brucker Brown, acting president in her capacity as commander-in-chief of the armed forces, has authorized all reserve officers and National Guard officers not in contact with their commanders or headquarters to take independent action to preserve public safety in those areas where civil defense has broken down or where organized military units do not exist. These officers will act in accordance with their best judgment under the proclamation of martial law. When possible, they will wear the uniform when exercising authority. I repeat this new..."
The signal hummed and faded. Randy clicked off the set. Even as he began to assimilate the significance of what he had heard, he was aware that Helen was standing on the other side of the counter. In her hand, she held a pair of scissors, comb, and a silver hand mirror. She was smiling. "Did you hear that?" he asked. "Yes. Today's your haircut day, Randy. Today's Friday." Helen trimmed his hair and Bill McGovern's fringe each Friday and barbered Dan and Ben Franklin Saturdays. "You know I'm in the reserve," Randy said. "I'm legal."
"What do you mean?"
"I had to pull my gun this morning to get Porky Logan buried. I had no authority. Now I do have authority, legally." His thoughts on the proclamation at the moment went no further.
That's fine. Now get into a chair.
He walked into his office. Because of the swivel chair, it was also the barber shop. Helen tied a towel around his neck and began snipping deftly and rapidly. She was some woman, he thought. Under any conditions, she could keep a household running smoothly. In 10 minutes, it was done. Her hand ruffled and then smoothed his hair. He could feel her breast, round and warm, pressing against his shoulder blade.
"You're getting gray hairs, Randy," she said. The timbre of her voice was deeper than usual.
"Who isn't?"
She rubbed and smoothed his temples. Her fingers kneaded the back of his neck. "Do you like that?" she whispered. "Mark loved it. When he came home tense and worried, I always rubbed his temples and his neck like this."
Randy said, "It feels fine." He wished she wouldn't talk like that. She made him nervous. He put his hands on the arms of the chair and started to rise. She pulled him back and whirled the chair so that he faced her. Her eyes were round. He could see beads of perspiration at the corners of her nose and on her forehead.
"You are Mark," she said. "Don't you believe me? Here, look."
She lifted the mirror from the desk and thrust it before his face. He looked, wondering how he could gracefully escape, wondering what was wrong with her. It was true that his face, leaner and harder, looked like Mark's face now. "I do look something like him," he admitted, "but why shouldn't I? I'm his brother." Her arms pinning him with unexpected strength, she kissed him wildly, as if her mouth could subdue and mold and change him. His hands found her wrists and he forced her back. The mirror fell and smashed.
"Don't," she cried. "Don't push me away. You're Mark. You can't deny it. You're Mark."
He struggled out of the chair, clamping her wrist, trying not to injure her. He knew that she was mad, and he fought to control the panic within himself. "Stop it," he heard himself shouting. "Stop it, Helen, stop it. I'm not Mark, I'm Randy."
She screamed, "Mark!"
The door was ajar. Through it came Lib's voice, loud and welcome.
"Randy, are you shorn? If Helen's finished, come on out. I've got something to show you."
He released Helen's wrists. She leaned against the desk, face averted, shoulders quivering, one hand stifling the sounds erupting from her mouth. He said gently,
"Please, Helen."
He touched her arm. She drew away from him. He fled into the living room. Lib stood at the porch door, her face somber, beckoning.
She said quietly, "Up to the roof where we can talk."
Randy followed her, knowing that she must have heard and grateful for her interference. It was something he would have had to tell Lib anyway. He would have to tell Dan, too. This emotional earthquake could bring down their house. It was a problem for a physician. Up on the captain's walk, Randy lowered himself carefully into a deck chair. The canvas would rot before summer's end. His hands were shaking.
"Did you hear it all?"
he asked.
"Yes, all, and saw some, too. Don't ever let her know."
"What's wrong with her?" It was a protest rather than a question. Lib sat on the edge of his chair and put her hands on his hands and said,
"Stop shaking, Randy. I know you're confused. It was inevitable. I knew it was coming. I'll diagnose it for you as best I can. It's a form of fantasy."
Randy was silent, wondering at her detachment and coolness.
"It is," she went on, "the sort of transference you find in dreams, the substitution in dreams of one person for another. Helen allowed herself to slip into a dream. I think she is a completely chaste person. She is, isn't she?"
"I'm sure of it, or I was."
"Yet she is a person who requires love and is used to it. For many years, a man has been the greater part of her life, so she has this conflict, intense loyalty to her husband, and yet need of a man to receive her abundance of love and affection. She tried to resolve the conflict irrationally. You became Mark. It was an hallucination."
"You're talking like a professional, Lib."
"I'm not a professional. I just wanted to be one. I majored in psychology, remember?" It was something she had told him, but he had forgotten because it seemed incongruous and not in the least important. Lib looked like a girl who had majored in ballet and water skiing at Miami rather than psychology at Sarah Lawrence. He knew that she worked for a year in a Cleveland clinic and had abandoned the job only because of her mother's illness. When she spoke of this year, which was seldom, it was with nostalgia, as some girls spoke of a year in Europe or on the stage. He suspected it must have been the most rewarding year of her life, and certainly there must have been a man or men in it. Randy said, "Lib, do you think she's crazy?" "Helen's not psychotic. She's under terrible strain. She let herself go, but only for a moment. She indulged a temporary fantasy. Now it is over. Now she will be ashamed of herself. The best thing you can do is pretend it didn't happen. One day she'll mention it to you, perhaps obliquely, and apologize. Eventually she'll understand why she did it, and the sense of guilt will leave her. One day, when we're better friends, I'll make her understand it. You know, there is a man in the house for Helen, a perfectly fine man. I'm going to make that my special project." Randy felt relieved. He looked out over the river, contemplating his ignorance of women and the peace of evening. On the end of the dock, Ben Franklin and Peyton were fishing. It was understood that anyone, child or adult, could go fishing before breakfast or after assigned chores were done. Fishing was not only recreation, but the necessary daily harvest of a crop providentially swimming at their feet. Presently, the brass ship's bell on the porch sang its sharp, clean sea note. The bell was a relic of Lieutenant Randolph Rousey Peyton's longboats. It was the same bell that Randy's mother had used to summon Mark and him from the river to wash for dinner. There was peace and continuity in the sound of the bell. The bell announced that there was food on the table and a woman in the kitchen. So it was not only a message to the children, but to Randy. Helen had pulled herself together. He watched Ben and Peyton, trailed by Graff, thread their way up through the grove. Graff still shared Randy's couch, but all day he shadowed the boy. This was right. A boy needed a dog. A boy also needed a father. When the children were close to the house, Randy yelled down, "What'd you get?" Ben held up a string of bream and speckled perch. 16, he shouted, "on worms and crickets. I got 15, she only got one." Peyton danced in indignation, a slim, shrill-voiced sprite. "Who cares about fish? If I grow up, I'm not going to be a fisherman." Helen called from the kitchen window. The children disappeared. Randy said, "Did you ever hear a little girl say, 'if I grow up' before?" "No, I never did. It gives me the creeps." "Not their fault," Randy said. "Ours." "Would you want children, Randy?" Randy considered the question. He thought of Jim Hickey's bees and Peyton's if, and of cow's milk you would not dare feed a baby in a contaminated zone, even if you had a cow, and of many other things. Lib waited a long time for an answer, and then she leaned across the chair and kissed him and said, "Don't try to answer now. I've got to go down and help with dinner. Don't come downstairs for a few minutes, Randy. We've whipped up a surprise." At 7, conscious that he had not heard Dan return, Randy went downstairs. The table was set as if for a feast. A white cloth, 2 new candles, a salad bowl as well as plate at each place. A laden salad boat of Haitian mahogany rode on the circular linen lagoon. Garnishing the inevitable platter of broiled fish was a necklace of mushrooms. He tasted the salad. It was delicate, varied, and wonderful. "Who invented this?" he asked. He had not tasted greens in months. Helen had not met his eyes since he entered the dining room. She said, "Alice Cooksey." Alice found a book listing edible palms, grasses, and herbs. Lib did most of the picking. "What all's in it?" "Fiddlehead ferns, hearts of palm, bamboo shoots, wild onions, some of the Admiral's ornamental peppers, and the first tomatoes out of Hannah Henry's garden." Lib said, "Wait till you try the mushrooms. That was Helen's idea.
It's funny, for the last week they've been growing all over right in front of our eyes, and only Helen recognized them as food.
No toadstools, I hope, Randy said.
Helen smiled and for the first time looked at him directly. Oh, no, Alice thought of that, too. I've been wandering around the hammock with an illustrated book in one hand and a basket in the other. Now that she could see he was treating the incident in his office as something that hadn't happened, she was regaining control of herself. He said, Helen, you be careful in that hammock. And Lib, you stay out of palm trees. We don't want any snake bites or broken legs. Dan has troubles enough. He put down his fork. Where is Dan? Nobody knew. Dan was usually home before 6. Occasionally, he was as late as this, or later when he encountered an emergency. Still, it was impossible not to worry. It was at times like this that Randy truly missed the telephone. Without communications, the simplest mechanical failure could turn into a nightmare and disaster. He finished the fish, mushrooms, and salad, but without appetite. Randy fidgeted until 8 and then said, I'm going to see the Admiral. Maybe Dan stopped there for dinner. He knew this was unlikely, but he tried in any case to visit Sam Hazard each evening and watch him comb the frequencies. There were other reasons. He stopped at the Wetcheck and Henry houses like a company commander checking his outposts. He slept uneasily unless he knew all was well around his perimeter. More compelling, Lib usually went with him. It was their opportunity to have a little time alone. It was paradoxical that they lived in the same house, ate almost every meal elbow to elbow or across the bar in his apartment, slept within 20 feet of each other, and yet they could be alone hardly at all. Ben Franklin said, Wait until I get the shotgun, Randy. I'll go with you. It's my night to stand guard. He raced upstairs. Helen said, Do you really think you ought to let him do it, Randy? It'd break his heart if I didn't. I think he'll be okay. Caleb is going to stay up with him, and Malachi will be right there. Malachi will sleep with one eye open. Why are you letting him have your shotgun? Because if something comes around the Henry's yard, I want him to hit it, not just pop away at it in the dark with a .22. I've taught him how to handle the shotty. It'll be loaded with .2 buck. He'll do all right. Ben came out on the porch carrying the gun. Lib said, Am I invited? Randy said, Certainly. He turned to Bill McGovern. If Dan shows up, give me 3 bells, will you? 3 strokes of the ship's bell meant come home, but it was not an emergency signal. 5 bells was the panic button. The bell could be heard for a mile along the shore and across water. Pale yellow lamplight showed in the Henry's windows. Randy knocked, and Missouri, looking almost svelte in a newly acquired waistline, opened the door. Mr. Randy, I guessed 'twas you. I want to thank you for the honey. Tasted mighty good. Will you come in and have some tea? Tea? Randy saw a kettle steaming on a brick oven in the fireplace. We calls it tea. I grow mints under the house and dry 'em until they powders, so we has mint tea. We'll skip it tonight, Mizzou. I just came to put Ben Franklin on his stand. Caleb ready? Missouri's son stepped out of the shadows, teeth and eyes gleaming. Incredibly, he carried a 6-foot spear. Let me see that, Randy said. He hefted it. It had been fashioned, he saw, from a broken garden edger, the blade ground to a narrow triangle. It was heavy, well-balanced, and lethal. Uncle Malachi made it for me, Caleb said proudly. It's a wicked weapon, all right, Randy said, and returned it to the boy. Malachi, carrying a lantern, joined them. Malachi said, I figured that if Ben Franklin messed with the shotgun, Caleb best have it for close-in defense, if it's truly a wolf, like Preacher says. Randy was certain that whatever had stolen the Henry's hens and the pig, it wasn't a wolf, but he wanted to impress Ben Franklin with the seriousness of his watch. Probably not a wolf, he said, but it could be a cougar, a panther. My father used to hunt 'em when he was young. Plenty of panther in Timaquin County until the first boom brought so many people down. Now there aren't so many people, so there will be more panther. They walked toward Ballam's tired barn. The mule snorted and rattled the boards in his stall.
"It's only me, Balaam," Malachi said.
"Balaam, quiet down."
Balaam quieted. Randy pointed to the bench alongside the barn.
"That's your stand, Ben."
Bill McGovern had sat on the bench the previous night and seen nothing.
"Stand?"
Ben Franklin said. "That's what you call it in a deer hunt. When I was your age, my father used to take me hunting and put me on a stand. There are a couple of things I want you to remember, Ben. Everything depends on you, and you, Caleb, keeping absolutely still. Whatever it is out there is better equipped than you are. It can see better, and hear better, and smell better. All you've got on it is brains. Your only chance of getting it is to hear it before it hears or sees you."
Randy looked at the sky.
There were only stars. Later there would be a quarter moon. "Chances are you'll hear it before you see it. But if you talk or make any sound, you'll never see it at all, because it'll hear you first and leave. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir," Ben said.
"You'll get cramped and you'll get tired, so when you sit on the stand, you move around all you want at first and find out just how far you can move without making any noise. You got shells in the chambers?"
"Yes, sir, and 4 extra in my pocket."
"You'll only need what's in the gun. If you don't get him with 2, you'll never get him at all. And Ben..."
"Yes, sir."
"Hold steady on it and don't miss. We want to get rid of this thing or somebody will have to sit up all night every night."
Ben said, "Randy, suppose it's a man."
This possibility had been restless in Randy's mind from the first, and he had not wanted to mention it, but since it was mentioned, he gave the unavoidable answer. "Whatever it is, Ben, shoot it. And Caleb, if he misses, I depend on you to stick it." He turned to Malachi. "Thanks for lighting us out. We're going on to Admiral Hazard's house now." "Good night, Malachi."
"Good night," Malachi said. "I sleep light, Mr. Randy."
Lib took his hand, and they walked to the riverbank and down the path that led toward the single square of light announcing that Sam Hazard was in his den. Randy chuckled, thinking of Caleb's spear.
"We have just witnessed an historic event," he said.
"What do you mean?" "North American civilization's return to the Neolithic Age."
"I don't think it's funny," Lib said. "I didn't like the way you spoke to Ben Franklin. It was brutal."
"In the Neolithic," Randy said, "a boy either grows up fast or he doesn't grow up at all." Sam Hazard's den was compact and crowded, like a shipmaster's cabin stocked for a long and lonely voyage. It was filled with mementos of his service, ceremonial and samurai swords, nautical instruments, charts, maps, books on shelves and stacked in corners, bound files of the Proceedings, the Foreign Affairs Quarterly, and the Annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science. The Admiral's L-shaped desk spread along 2 walls. One side was preempted by the professional-looking shortwave receiver and his radio log. The radio was turned on, but when Randy and Lib entered the room, all they heard was a low hum. Sam Hazard was not as tall as Lib, and his weathered skin was drawn tautly over fine bones. In slippers and dragon-blazoned shantung robe, his implacable gray eyes shadowed and softened by the indistinct lighting and horn-rimmed glasses, cottony hair like a halo, he appeared fragile, a deception. He was tough as an antique ivory figurine which has withstood the vicissitudes of centuries and can accept more. He said,
"A place for the lady to sit."
He sailed a plastic model of the carrier Wasp, the old Wasp sighted by Churchill for stinging twice in the Mediterranean and then herself stung to death by torpedoes, to the far corner of the desk.
"Up there," he ordered Lib, "where you can be properly admired. And you, Randy, lift those books out of that chair. Gently, if you please. Welcome aboard to both of you."
Randy said, "You haven't seen Dan Gunn, have you?"
"No, not today. Why?"
"He hasn't come home."
"Missing, eh? That sounds ungood, Randy."
"If he comes home while we're out, Helen or Bill will ring the bell. Can we hear it in here?"
Yes, indeed, so long as the window's open. It always startles me.
Randy saw that the Admiral had been working. The Admiral was writing something he called, without elaboration, a footnote to history. A portable typewriter squatted in the center of a ring of books. Research, Randy supposed. He recognized Durant's Caesar and Christ, Gibbon's Decline and Fall, and Vom Krieg by Clausewitz, indicating a footnote to ancient history. Randy said, "Any poop this evening?"
"I suppose you heard the civil defense broadcast.
I caught part of it, then my batteries quietly expired." The Admiral gave his attention to the radio. He turned the knob, changing frequencies.
"I've been listening for a station in a 31-meter band. Claims to be in Peru. I heard it for the first time last night. It put out some pretty outlandish stuff. It doesn't seem to be on yet, so we'll try for it again later. I've just switched to 5.7 megacycles. That's an Air Force frequency I can tap sometimes. You've never heard it, Randy? Interesting, but cryptic."
The speaker squealed and whined.
"Somebody's transmitter is open," the Admiral interpreted. "Something's coming."
A voice boomed with shocking loudness in the small room. "Sky Queen, Sky Queen, do not answer. Do not answer. This is Big Rock. This is Big Rock. Applejack, repeat. Applejack, authentication X-ray." Lib spoke excitedly. "What is it? What does it mean?" Hazard smiled.
"I don't know. I'm not up on Air Force codes and jargon. I've heard that Sky Queen call two or three times in the past month. Sky Queen could be a bomber, or a patrol plane, or a whole wing or air division. Big Rock, whoever that is, could be telling Sky Queen, whatever she may be, any number of things. Proceed to target, orbit, continue patrol, come home, all is forgiven. I can't even make an informed guess. However, I do know this. That was a good American call, and so we're still in business."
The smile departed.
"On the other hand, it indicates that the enemy is still in business, too."
"How do you figure?" Randy asked.
"That do not answer phrase. Why does Big Rock order Sky Queen to be silent? Because if Sky Queen acknowledges the call, then somebody might be able to take a radio fix on her. Estimate speed and course and vector fighters, or launch ground-to-air rockets to shoot her down."
Randy considered this. "Then Sky Queen is probably stooging around over enemy territory."
"That's good deduction, but we can't be certain. For all we know, Sky Queen may be hunting a sub off Daytona. Makes me wild listening to the damn Air Force. You will please pardon me, Lib. But if the enemy is listening on this frequency, it must make them wild, too."
Lib asked, "What did that authentication X-ray stand for?"
"X-ray is simply international code for the letter X. My guess is that before every mission, they change the authentication letter so that the enemy can't take over the frequency and give Sky Queen a false heading or phony instructions."
"You know, I enjoyed hearing that," Lib said. "It gave me a nice feeling. Big Rock has a solid Midwest accent." Sam Hazard moved a candle so that better light fell on his dials.
"Big Rock won't be back again tonight," he said. "I've never heard him more than once a night. He makes his call, and that's it. I'll try the 31-meter band again."
In the candlelight, Hazard's hands shone with the silky, translucent patina of age, and yet they were remarkably deft. They discovered a fascinating squeal. His fingers worked the band spreader delicately as a master cracksman violating a safe, and he pressed his face forward as if he expected to hear tumblers click. Very gradually, a faint voice replaced the squeal. He turned up the power. They heard in English, with an indefinite accent,
"Continuing the news to North America. The representative of the Argentine has informed the South American Federation that two ships with wheat have sailed for Nice in southern France, responding to radio appeals from that city. The appeals from Nice say that several hundred thousand refugees are camped in makeshift shelter on the Côte d'Azur. Many are starving. The casino at Monaco and the Prince's Palace have been converted into hospitals. In a Spanish-language broadcast heard here today, Radio Tokyo announced that the Big Three meeting in New Delhi has approved preliminary plans for flying desperately needed vaccines and antitoxins to uncontaminated cities in Europe, North America, and Australia.
Big Three, Randy said. Who's the Big Three?
Shh, said the Admiral. Maybe we'll find out. The announcer continued.
China, where Save Asia First sentiment is strong, urged that first priority for vaccine aerial shipments go to the Soviet Union's maritime provinces where typhus is reported. India and Japan felt that the smallpox epidemic on the west coast of the United States, Canada, and in Mexico should receive equal priority. The universal shortage of aviation gasoline will make any quick aid difficult. However,
the squeal insinuated itself into the voice and subdued it. Hazard caressed the band spreader. The atmospherics have been crazy ever since the day. Abruptly, he asked Randy, "Do you believe it?"
"It's weird," Randy said. "Maybe it's a Soviet bloc propaganda station pretending to be South American set up to confuse us and start rumors. I'll admit I'm confused. I thought the Chinese were in it, on the other side."
"The Chinese never liked Russia's preoccupation with the Med," Hazard said. "Maybe they opted out, which would be smart of them. It could be simpler. If they didn't have nuclear capability, we wouldn't bother hitting them on the day, and without nuclear weapons, they wouldn't dare stick their noses into a real war. If that was it, they were lucky."
"I noticed that station quoted Tokyo. How is it you didn't hear Tokyo?"
"I've never been able to pick up any Asiatic stations. I used to get Europe fine. London, Moscow, Bonn, Bern, Africa too. Especially the Voice of America transmitter in the Tangier. Not anymore. Not since the day."
The signal cleared. They heard.
"But as yet, the Big Three have been unable to reopen communications with Dmitry Torgats. According to Radio Tokyo, Torgats headed the Soviet government while the Soviet Union's capital was in Ulaanbaatar in Outer Mongolia. The medium-wave station operation from Ulaanbaatar is no longer heard."
"That doesn't sound like Soviet propaganda to me," Randy said. "Who is Dmitry Torgats?" The Admiral glanced up at a shelf of reference works. He selected a slender book, Directory of Communist Leaders, found the name and read,
"Torgats, Dmitry, born Leningrad, 1903, married, wife's name unlisted, children unlisted, director Leningrad Agitprop, 1946-49, candidate member, presidium, 1950-53, director, waterworks, Narian Mar, Siberia, since fall of Malenkov."
"Looks like they had a shake-up," Randy said. "It looks like they had to reach way down and find a minor league bureaucrat."
"Yes, it's surprising that Torgats should be running Russia," the Admiral said. "Until you consider that a female last on the list of cabinet members is running the United States."
Randy could see that Lib wasn't listening. She was staring at the tassel of a sword resting on pegs behind his head, her lips parted, eyes unblinking. Her thoughts, he had discovered, frequently raced ahead of his or sped down dark and fascinating byways. When she concentrated thus, she left the party. She murmured, "Smallpox." Not understanding that Lib mentally was no longer in the room with them, Sam Hazard inquired,
"What about smallpox?"
"Oh," Lib shook her head, "I think of smallpox as something out of the Middle Ages, like the Black Plague. It's true that every so often it cropped up, but we always slapped it down again. What happens now without vaccine? What about diphtheria and yellow fever? Will they start up again? Without penicillin and DDT, where are we? All good things came to us automatically. We were born with silver spoons in our mouths and electric dishwashers to keep them sanitary and clean. We relaxed, didn't we? What happened to us, Admiral?
Sam Hazard disconnected the radio's batteries and pulled his chair around to face them. I've been trying to find the answer.
He nodded at his typewriter and the books massed on his desk.
I've been trying to put it down in black and white and pass it along. Up to now, no bottom. All I've found out was where I myself and my fellow professionals failed. I'll explain.
He opened a drawer and drew out a folder.
I called this a footnote to history. You see, I was in the Pentagon when we were having the big hassles on roles and missions, and it occurred to me that I might be one of the few still alive who knew the inside of what went on and how the decisions were reached, and I thought that future historians might be interested. So I set it all down factually. I set down all the arguments between the big carrier admirals and the atomic seaplane admirals and the ICBM generals and pentatomic division generals and heavy bomber generals and manned missile generals. I told how we finally achieved what we thought was a balanced establishment. When I finished, I read it over and realized it was a farce. He tossed the manuscript on the desk as if he were discarding unwanted fourth-class mail. You see, I confused the tactical with the strategic. I think we all did. The truth is this. Once both sides had maximum capability in hydrogen weapons and efficient means of delivering them, there was no sane alternative to peace. Every maxim of war was archaic. The rules of Clausewitz, Mahan, all of them were obsolete as the Code Duello. War was no longer an instrument of national policy, only an instrument for national suicide. War itself was obsolete. So my footnote deals with tactical palavers of no real importance. We might as well have been playing on the rug with lead soldiers. The Admiral rose and unkinked his back. I think most of us sensed this truth, but we could not accept it. You see, no matter how well we understood the truth, it was necessary that the Kremlin understand it too. It takes two to make a peace, but only one to make a war. So all we could do, while vowing not to strike first, was line up our lead soldiers.
That was all you could do? Lib asked.
All. The answer was not in the Pentagon or even in the White House. I'm looking elsewhere. One place here. He tapped Gibbon. There are odd similarities between the end of the Pax Romana and the end of the Pax Americana, which inherited Pax Britannica. For instance, the prices paid for high office. When it became common to spend $1 million to elect senators from moderately populous states, I think that should have been a warning to us. For instance, free pap for the masses, bread and circuses, Roman spectacles in our spectaculars, largesse from the conquering proconsuls and television giveaways from the successful lipstick king. To understand the present, you must know the past. Yet, it is only part of the answer, and I will never discover it all. I have not the years.
Randy saw that the Admiral was tired. I guess we'd better get back, he said. Thanks for an entertaining evening.
Next time you come over, Hazard said, I want you to look at my invention.
Are you inventing something, too? Everybody's inventing something.
Yes. It's called a sailboat. It's a means of propulsion that replaces the gasoline kicker. I sacrificed my flagpole and patio awning to make it. The cutting and sewing was done by Florence Wetcheck in Missouri and Hannah Henry. I can now recommend them as experienced sailmakers.
Thanks, Sam, Randy grinned. That's a wonderful invention and will become popular. I know I'm going to get one right away, and I will use your firm of sailmakers. They walked to the path along the riverbank.
Swinging at its buoy, Randy saw the Admiral's compact little cruiser with covered foredeck. Useless kicker removed, a slender mast arcing its tip at a multitude of stars. There were many sailboats on Florida's lakes, but Randy had seen very few in the upper reaches of the St. John's or on the Timequin. "I love the Admiral," Lib said. "I worry about him. I wonder whether he gets enough to eat."
"The Henrys see that he eats, and Missouri keeps his place neat. The Henrys love him, too."
"As long as we have men like that, I can't believe we're so decadent. We won't go like Rome, will we?" He didn't answer. He swung it around to face him and circled her waist with his hands. His fingers almost met. She was so slim. He said, "I love you. I worry about you. I wonder whether I tell you enough how I love you and want you and need you and how I am diminished and afraid when you are not with me and how I am multiplied when you are here." His arms went around her and he felt her body arch to him, molding itself against him. "There never seems to be enough time," he said, "but tonight there is time. When we get home." She said, "Yes, Randy." They walked on, his arm around her waist. "This is a bad time for love," she said. "Oh, I don't mean tonight is a bad time. I mean the times. When you love someone, that should be what you think of most, the first thing when you wake in the morning and the last thing before you sleep at night. Before the day, that's how I thought of you. Did you know that? First in the morning, last at night." Randy knew, without her saying it, that it must be the same for her as it was for him. At day's end, a man was exhausted, physically, mentally, emotionally. Each sun heralded a new crisis, and each night he bedded with old, relentless fears. He awoke thinking of food and fell onto his couch at night still hungry, his head whirling with problems unsolved and dangers unparried. The Germans, in their years of methodical madness, had discovered in their concentration camps that when a man's diet fell below 1,500 calories, his desire and capacity for all emotions dwindled. Randy guessed that he managed to consume almost 1,500 calories each day in fish and fruit alone. His vigor was being expended in survival, he decided, that and worry for the lives dependent upon him. Even now, he could not exclude worry for Dan Gunn from his mind. The hodgepodge outlines of the Henry place loomed out of the darkness above them. They were within 50 yards of the barn, and Ben Franklin was somewhere in that shadow, shotgun.